the protesters, but it wasn't clear whether there were orders given for the police to melt away or not. The same thing happened in Egypt when the army took to the streets, remember?
But there was an army. They didn't bring in outside, like Saudi
Right.
troops or something,
Right.
Saudi policemen. So to create, you would think they wouldn't have faded out unless they had their own military. What is the situation in Bahrain in terms of the Bahrainian military?
Well, the Saudi military is part of this Gulf Cooperation Council. It was invited in as part of the GCC,
But
actually.
why can't Bahrain do this themselves?
Well, I think they don't have the same size military as the Saudis do, and they're not nearly as well armed. And it's clearly a show of force by the monarchy that they want to put down these protests after 4 weeks.
So just to remind everybody, anyone following the story knows this, the American Fifth Fleet is based there.
Right.
So there's a lot at stake geopolitically for the United States here. But the way the media has been describing this is a Sunni-Shia conflict, almost suggesting this is like based on religious ideological divisions. Is that what you think is going on?
I think clearly, Paul, it's an issue of economic opportunity. I mean, the Sunnis are the minority and they hold all the power. The Shia are about 75% of the country, and they are discriminated against for jobs, for positions in the military and the government sector. So it clearly is a very neat division between Sunni and Shia. However, I don't think if you asked any of the protesters in the streets, you wouldn't find them saying that they want a Shia-led theocracy or anything like this. They want economic opportunity. So it happens that the Sunni monarchy has been lording over them, and the Shia majority just want to see more opportunity for
So
themselves.
you think it's somewhat disingenuous then to portray this as Saudi Arabia coming to the rescue of Bahraini monarchy, in other words, to stop Iran, which is the way this thing's kind of being positioned, especially by the television pundits.
It's really easy to say, you know, Sunnis and Saudi on one side and the Shia majority and Iran on the other. And I think clearly both Saudi Arabia and Iran, the two regional powers, are jockeying for influence here. Bahrain is tiny, but as you say, very strategic. And I think both sides, both outside powers, are going to try to use this for their advantage. Now, I don't think the majority of people in Bahrain want to see an outside power dictate what happens in their country. However, you know, the monarchy, you know, Saudi is their biggest backer, apart from the U.S., for example, with the Fifth Fleet there. The monarchy, the Khalifa family, depends on the Saudi monarchy. And Saudi Arabia is also very eager to avoid any kind of spillover from what's happening in Bahrain into eastern Saudi Arabia, where there is a very large and very unhappy Shia population as well.
So this is more about defending the privilege of these elites than it is about stopping the onslaught of the Iranian Shia hordes, is the kind of picture we're painted for us.
Well, I think if they can stop, if they can put down the rebellion, they'll be happy, and that also means that they can keep Iran out of Bahrain. That'll make them.
Is there any indication that the Shia that are protesting in Bahrain want Iran in Bahrain?
I don't think so. I've heard nothing to suggest that the Shia are trying to invite anybody inside to resolve these issues. They want the monarchy to go, and they want you know, they want a constitutional system where they can you know, have rights.
So there's no reason to think this isn't a democracy movement as it is in other countries,
Yeah.
the other countries of the Middle
That's
East.
what they've been demanding from day one.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was McClatchy Middle East reporter Shashank Bengali speaking to Paul Jay with the Real News Network. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Our headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. Thanks to KPFA, the Real News Network, Nathan Moore, the FSRN Board and Steering Committee, and many others for relentless work to make sure FSRN stays on the air. For more information on how you can support FSRN, go to our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.
And it's 1 minute after 7 o'clock. You're listening to radio station WBAI New York. The time, well, actually, time being 7:01, it's time for Off the Hook.
So I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving. Now I can't make a call. It couldn't get much worse. But if they could, they would. Oh, they live on for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. But they live on.
And getting started by the program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Mike.
Hi.
Dot Rhett.
Hello.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Voltaire.
Hey.
Kyle.
Yes, hello.
Jim.
Hi.
And down in Philadelphia, Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia.
Well, it's been one hell of a week for the world. That's for sure. Watching news developments coming from the other side of the planet, and seeing how quickly things can just spiral out of control. Of course, referring to the I don't think I have to mention it to people listening in the press. When people do listen to our show 10 years in the future, and they might wonder just what is the significance. Well, last Friday, Japan was hit by a 8.9? Was it 9.?
It's been upgraded to a 9.0.
9.0 earthquake, which then caused a tsunami, which was devastating, and all kinds of videos of that we've been seeing all over the place. And then, as if that weren't enough. A nuclear disaster, as one particular nuclear plant has been hit by all kinds of explosions and fires, and radioactive leaks, and nobody really knows what's going on. In fact, the headline in today's New York Times: "Peril and Confusion at Japanese Nuclear Plant." United States urges wider no-go area around nuclear plant. Anger over Japan nuclear exodus. There's all kinds of chaos and mayhem going on over there as we speak. We don't know a whole lot about the situation that we can really help with.
But people are angry over the exodus?
Well, people are angry over the way it's being handled. Basically, information just isn't out there as much as you might expect. There are 6 reactors at the Fukushima plant. And according to this BBC entry, this environmental correspondent said, over the days of the crisis, attention has switched from reactor 1 to reactor 3 to 2, back to 3, and now to 4. And this is a surprise because reactors 4, 5, and 6 were shut down at the time of Friday's earthquake, with some or all of their fuel rods extracted and left in cooling ponds that each reactor building has under its roof. And once the reactor is turned off, radioactivity and heat generation in the rods die away quickly. The question
is, quickly.
I'm sorry?
Not that quickly.
Well, apparently not. The question is, why is it that the Tokyo Electric Power Company, known as TEPCO, has warned the possibility of re-criticality is not zero? I don't think I've ever said that word before. If you're in any doubt as to what this means, it is that in the company's view, it is possible that enough uranium is present in enough density to form a critical mass in the cooling pond, meaning that a nuclear fission reaction could start in the building outside the containment shield that surrounds the actual reactor. If that happened, it would lead to the enhanced and sustained release of radioactive materials, though not a nuclear explosion. Basically, there's a lot of misinformation and rumors going around, and also there are a lot of people who are being contained, who are being isolated from the population because they've been exposed to radiation. And I've been watching some video of this: families separated through glass, and people on the wrong side of the glass aren't being treated very well, according to what we've heard. So what we're going to try to do now, we have one of our listeners, actually. Stuart from Tokyo has posted an incredible story, his observations on how technology worked and how technology did not work throughout this crisis. And you can find that on our main webpage, www.2600.com. What we're going to try to do now is reach Stuart live over there in Tokyo, where it's, I believe, 8 in the morning over there, 8:07. And I'm not sure if the circuits will work. That's one thing we have to keep trying. If they don't, there's been a lot of activity, obviously, calling into Japan, and we'll find out more about that. But before I make the attempt, anybody else have any observations or comments or things they'd like to share on this situation?
Yeah, just there seems to be a lot of, especially if you rely on the American mainstream news, a lot of sort of conflicting information about what's actually going on out there. It's kind of hard to separate the sensationalism from the solid facts. There's one blog. It's at mitnse.com, though I might be wrong on the suffix, but it's run by some experts at MIT who are blogging the actual scientific facts of the situation as it develops, rather than the sensationalism and catchy headlines.
Well, have you seen examples of the sensationalism?
Just basically from every different direction, there seems to be something, a completely different story going on, and they all seem to be sort of apocalyptic and I think at one point, if you were watching enough channels, you were assured that we were both doomed and perfectly safe and in the process of exploding and just fine and secure forever, all at the same time simultaneously. And it's
Well, let me just for the sake of people that might be looking for some alternative views, apart from WBAI, apart from listening on the internet and finding different sources on the internet. If you have cable television and you're, say, in the Cablevision area, there are three channels that I can think of that would be better than the domestic garbage that we tend to get here. Channel 103 is Euronews. Channel 104 is BBC World News. And the Cablevision has also opened up Channel 265, which is a live a television station from Japan. It's in Japanese, but it's a godsend for people who are concerned and speak Japanese to find out what's going on over there, and at least in the view of Japanese media. Here in Manhattan, Time Warner Channel 133 is CNN International, which is very different from CNN Domestic. And you'll get a lot more international coverage and live breaking news and things like that.
That's NHK, the Japanese.
It's not NHK. No, it's not NHK. In fact, I can't find anybody who carries NHK World, which is the English language world network equivalent to BBC World News. You can watch that online too. But the station that's on channel 265 on Cablevision is Japanese, purely Japanese. It's interesting to see. You see all kinds of maps and diagrams and video footage, but it is all in Japanese, as it should be for people who are most concerned with what's going on over there. Okay, we're going to give a try calling overseas here. Let's get a dial tone. All right. And it's going to hit those digits and hopefully not transmit them over the air. And we tried this before the show, and it actually worked. So fingers crossed. Let's see how long it takes. And rings in Japan always sound like they're underwater for some reason. And that one does not. Oh, dear. Wonder where this is going.
Are you calling a real Japanese phone number?
Yes. Well, we called it before, and it sounded like a real Japanese number. But if this didn't work, it should be going to an error message or something. Okay, here we go.
We're sorry. Your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please check the area code and number and dial again.
Okay, so she's accusing me of not dialing properly, which is entirely possible because I didn't hear the tones. It's possible that the sticky keypad here did not work, so we're going to try it again.
Well, we can maybe transmit the country code at least over the air.
Well, yeah, okay. The country code is 81. We're dialing 011, and then 81, and then the number, which I'm going to turn it down for, and hope that it actually goes through. Did we hit a pound sign at the end of it last time? Because I didn't do that this time. All right. Sometimes you should hit a pound sign when dialing overseas, sometimes not. Let's try this. There you go.
Hello, Stu speaking.
Stuart, hi, it's Emmanuel off the hook.
Hi, how are you?
Good. The real question is, how are you holding up?
I'm okay. It's a beautiful sunny morning here in the Miura Peninsula just outside of Tokyo.
Well, we've been hearing all kinds of disturbing reports that Tokyo itself, because of the direction that the wind was blowing earlier, was in the path of the plume, the radioactive plume, and a lot of people are walking around with masks or not walking around at all. How would you compare the scene in Tokyo right now to the way it was, say, a week or two ago?
Well, I haven't been up to Tokyo since the quake. I've been working at home since then, mainly because of the disruption to the train service, and that's a follow-on because of a lack of power. So there's a rolling blackout, which affecting train service, but I have in front of me a online Geiger counter, and we're now at 20 counts per minute, which is totally normal in the Tokyo area. A few days ago, I saw it spike up to about 40 on the counts per minute. But again, that's very normal. There's areas around the world, populated areas, where 100 is the norm. So we can see fluctuations in the radiation level, but they're in Tokyo area, they're well within the norm.
Now, how far away are you from the actual plant?
So we're a few hundred kilometers away. It would take about maybe 5 hours to drive up there from Tokyo, and I'm about an hour from Tokyo.
Okay, and the maximum evacuation area that I have heard said is something like 60 kilometers, I believe, is the highest. The Japanese authorities are saying more like 10 or 20 kilometers.
Well, what they've imposed was there's a 20-kilometer kind of exclusion zone where everybody's been evacuated, and then from 20 to 30 kilometers, it's a stay indoors as much as possible zone, which we're getting various reports from, like, around the world and about this, and they say that's the norm for this scale of accident right now.
Now, it's bizarre because this is happening, and of course there was a double natural calamity that occurred on Friday, the major earthquake and the huge tsunami, and it's almost like that's being put on the back page because of all the fear about the radiation and nuclear accident. But how are people, how is the media handling all of this?
Yeah, so you're right there. The media seems to be very much focused on the nuclear situation right now. There's constant press conferences going on the Japanese TV regularly talking about that. We're seeing quite a lot of video coming in as various towns have been reached and communication reestablished. The home video that people took is gradually coming in. So even like days later, we're getting, like, on the street video of the tsunami rolling in and you know, washing whole communities away.
Yeah, well, I think many of us have seen similar, if not the same, video, and it's simply shocking to see that. What is your view of how the NHK and the rest of Japanese media have been handling the story?
Well, I think NHK is almost in waiting for this kind of disaster, because and the other TV channels also and media, they react very quickly. We have earthquakes on, as you know, on a regular basis. So always the program will stop the live camera from wherever the earthquake has taken place. Like, usually there's a camera in the newsroom, so you see the cabinet shaking and people kind of putting on hard hats from the local TV stations. And then outside the TV stations, they have the cameras on the street looking over show signs wobbling, or cameras in the ports that are expected to receive a tsunami. And most cases, like 99% of the time, it is nothing happens at all. It's just a very small quake. And if a tsunami happens, it's 10 centimeters. But even at that time, there's a illustrated map that's projected over the screen of the regular TV program, which may continue running, which is showing the red areas where the danger is thought to be. So they have people ready in helicopters, seem to be go out immediately over affected areas, because in many cases it's not clear what the actual extent of the quake damage is. So I'm sure the governments are watching the same TV program as those news helicopters go out and film it. And this time we saw, as you said, those extraordinary scenes of the tsunami coming in over the airport and the farmland, just washing away glass houses in a big brown, dirty wave. I think that's never been seen before. I think this is the first time that the actual footage has been displayed on live TV. And when I was in the office, I was getting a lot of messages, seeing a lot of messages coming in, and it was unbelievable what people were describing, because they didn't know how to describe it. And secondhand, you know, we really didn't know what to make of it. and then we could start to see the TV by ourselves and understand, wow, this is something very different.
Yeah, it really is. Now, you say you saw pictures of the tsunami happening live over TV?
Yeah, people who were in their house and watching TV would have seen it live. The channel would have immediately gone over to the helicopter view. And so I was receiving, looking at Twitter at the time, and many messages coming in with people just describing what they were seeing on the TV.
Now, you wrote an amazing piece that's currently featured on our front page about just the various ways that technology worked and did not work throughout this this disaster. I think in particular you focused on social networks and how they played a part and how certain things that you might expect to work weren't really working all that well.
That's right. So as I've written about it, I suddenly realized that a day or so afterwards how all of this came together. At the time, we were just desperate for information. So the immediate thought is to call your relatives or your family nearby, but shortly after the earthquake occurred, the cell phone service was totally unobtainable. Calls weren't going through, but it occurred to me that I was getting like mail to my phone and other services which are based on the IP network, and that was fine. And I really don't know why cell phone service goes down, whether it's overloading at the time or they want to retain the quality of service so they just don't accept calls when the network is heavily used. But all of those IP services, the web, and even Skype were working fine. And some people were receiving calls from their relatives overseas via Skype on their mobile phone, but they couldn't call the neighboring town on landline or on the mobile network. And a lot of people have changed over their analog landline to kind of integrate it with the fiber internet service, but that is only available when the power is up, and there were the immediate blackouts in some areas. So those people who had a fiber connection were down at that point, even with their landline. And I heard that the old analog landlines, people who had those, they could get through.
Wow, this is sounds familiar. It's something that we've been saying for years, that the landlines are really the only way to stay connected in crises like this. Mm-hmm. Now, how did the cellular network hold up?
So it was really bad. The connection we had, like we had three bars, four bars, perfect connection, but you couldn't put a call through. As I was saying, we were able to contact social networks via the IP services, like the browser and the client on iPhone and other smartphones. So we could get feedback about, for example, the earthquake report, the actual epicenter, the magnitude at the epicenter, and I was able to contact friends later in the day to find a place to stay, because the trains all stopped, and quite soon it was announced that they wouldn't be starting till the following morning. So all train services in and out of Tokyo were down, and many people stayed in their offices. The companies immediately put their own kind of disaster plan into effect and allowed people to stay, and did their best to provide with food and drinks and other comforts.
Well, now the way that you got that situation resolved, though, is interesting. You posted your situation on Facebook, and within a few minutes, you started receiving offers of places to stay.
That's right. Actually, it's I have a very kind of complicated setup where, like, Twitter echoes over to Facebook. So I didn't really intend to post it over to Facebook at that time, but it just, you know, got picked up by my Twitter feed, and people said, oh yeah, if you're nearby, then you know, please come over. And it was people that I hadn't thought about that actually were living quite close by, but I would never have thought about calling them up and said, oh, you know, could I stay with you? But the friend that I did stay with, I got through to him via Skype chat, so I could communicate real time on chat. And then as I walked about 30 minutes to his place outside, I wasn't quite sure which building it was, so I called him on the Skype voice chat, and that worked fine.
But if you had tried conventional methods, just using your cell phone to call, you wouldn't be able to get through at all.
That's right, yeah.
Very interesting.
So that was Skype from the cell phone, but the actual cell network wasn't working.
And just to divert for a moment, the actual cell network, the type of system you use, it's not anything like the system we use here.
So there's various incompatible systems here. We have the AU network, which is a CDMA network. We have the Docomo network and the SoftBank networks. I forget which protocols they're running on, but in general, you can't use a standard GSM phone to make calls.
Nor can you use a CDMA phone, because when I was over there, I had a CDMA and a GSM phone, and neither one worked.
Right. Yeah, it's on a different frequency,
I see. So other bits of technology that worked and didn't work, anything come to mind?
One of the things that was very useful was kind of real-time search. Now, I had a little bit been skeptical of the value of the real-time search, which is some time back Google paid a license fee to Twitter just to take their whole stream of data, and they put their own search engine around that. And for the first time, I used that to be able to look for a station name or a train line and see the status at that time, because people were complaining, like, you know, on their Twitter, you know, saying, oh, the station's very crowded, there's like a 500-meter line outside the station, the website for the train company says it's up, but actually the doors are closed. So by focusing in on particular stations and particular train lines, I was able to know that a certain train station would be closed. Or if you walked one stop down the line, that station at that moment was empty. So it was very, very useful to plan my journey back home. And in the end, I traveled back on a near empty train.
Now, you used, what was the service that you used for this? What service of Google?
It's called the Google Realtime. I think it's google.com/realtime, or if you search on their site, you'll come up with it. And it gives you you can search the real-time information that they have, and then it will refresh the search.
Fascinating. So you'll see what people are saying as they say it, and I guess going to the actual official websites wouldn't have got you any useful information at all if you were even able to connect to them.
That's right. They just gave their expected service. And what happened with the trains? I passed through Shinagawa, and so Shinagawa is a major major terminus, and many people have to change there. So the station became overloaded, and so what they did, I think, was to just shut the gate on the lines, and That allowed the trains from Shinagawa to leave empty, and start clearing down the line, picking up people, so that when the Shinagawa opened again, the people would be able to go in the trains, and there wouldn't be such a crush further down the line. And by also shutting it, people were walking along the line to the next station, just kind of walking home, and then finding that they could get on at the next station, which gave like a 20 or 30 minute buffer so that the train station could kind of reduce the density of the people there to be able to continue. So I'm not sure how they plan for this, but about once a year we get a similar situation when there's a typhoon or some other trouble.
We're speaking with Stuart, one of our listeners and friends from Japan. Stuart, now you're how far from Tokyo right now?
I'm about 55 kilometers, which is just over an hour on the train. And I usually commute up there every day.
And would you have any trouble getting there today if you wanted to?
I think the train's on a reduced service today. And one of the problems we've been having is that due to the power stations being taken offline, Tokyo is very, very close to exceeding the kind of the maximum power output to consume all of the power output the electricity companies can generate. So they've split the Tokyo and surrounding areas into zones and having a rolling blackout for 3 hours at a time.
And when we were communicating earlier, I think you mentioned that your rolling blackout was scheduled for 20 past the hour?
Yes, so it's quite funny because in my building and just my surrounding area, we have had the announcement over the loudspeaker system that there will be a blackout, but my particular building hasn't been affected, and a little bit around my building hasn't been affected. And today I was thinking maybe there is some critical infrastructure in this local area. And we're quite close to the Japanese Self-Defense Force base, so they probably don't want to take the base power down. So I'm guessing that's the reason why half of the town has been affected and my half of the town hasn't been affected.
Stuart?
By that. Yeah.
Hi, Stuart. This
Hello
is Bernie S.
Hi, Bernie.
Thanks for contacting us, by the way. It's great information you're providing. I think you explained when we were corresponding via email that throughout Japan, there's a mobile phone warning system in place to warn people of tsunamis.
Right. Yep.
How did that work or not work this time?
Okay, so the warning system is fairly new. So as of maybe 2 or 3 years ago, in the normal Japanese feature phone, it's been built in that the network will send a broadcast message and a siren will go off, and it's the same sound no matter which phone you have. So a few months back, suddenly the whole room just filled with this siren of an earthquake coming in. And at first nobody knew what it was. It was the first time that it happened. And it's very strange when all around you the same sound is occurring. It's like a weird stereo effect because there are people in different parts of the room. So that at the time seemed like a very good idea, and the way it works is that the various monitoring systems can pick up the earthquakes very quickly, but the actual ground waves are quite slow in comparison to the speed that we can transmit over the phone network. So it's possible to get a few seconds warning that an earthquake will occur. But on the Friday earthquake, there was no warning at all by the system, and I don't know what happened, why that didn't happen. But after the earthquake had occurred, variously throughout the night, there were warnings coming over the mobile phone, but mostly for kind of low intensity earthquakes. So right now, it doesn't seem to be working very well in that. You don't know what to do when you hear the sound, like whether it's going to be a big earthquake or a small earthquake, and in most cases it's been a small one.
Do you think that had that worked, people would have been able to seek high ground soon enough to avoid? What do you think?
Well, for the people in the areas where the tsunamis occur, they have regular drills, like at least once a year, the whole town runs up to the hill. And they know, they're trained from an early age at school. Like even the kids at school have know exactly what to do to get under the desk and to put on some kind of a head covering that they have. So those areas where the tsunami occurred, they had warning via the local government loudspeaker system, and they knew that an earthquake, a very strong earthquake, had occurred. So they ran immediately. As soon as they feel a strong earthquake, they run immediately. But this time, the earthquake came within 9 minutes. So you have 9 minutes to decide which way you're going to go. And I was reading today that in some of the places, there's a blue line that's painted on the road, and you just run along the blue line, and that will take you up to the closest point. So pretty much there was nothing more they can do. Once they heard that siren go off and felt the ground shake, they were running.
Stuart, you said there was some kind of loudspeaker system in your neighborhood that tells you when the power is going to go out. What's that all about?
Okay, so all around Japan, every neighborhood, there is a loudspeaker, and once a day, about 5 o'clock, there's a tune is played over the loudspeaker. It's kind of to tell children it's time to go home, you know, to stop playing in the park and just to go back to your parents at dinner time. That kind
of throughout the entire country, really.
Throughout all of the major cities or villages, anywhere you know that's a small gathering of houses. Now, we get announcements, for example, flood warnings when there's a typhoon, and other various warnings over the speaker. But the interesting thing is that I can hear it in the distance. I can hear the announcement in the distance, and then I can hear the announcement locally, and then I can hear the announcement in the distance again. So, and after the announcement finishes, I can hear the off-the-hook tone of the telephone system. So it seems like they're calling in to some local system to broadcast.
Very interesting. I assume the off-the-hook tone isn't the same as it is here in the States.
Yeah, it just sounds like they forgot to hang up the phone, and then you hear it clicks off.
Interesting. Now, I think you also mentioned that SMS messages weren't actually going through, and there's really no way to know if they went through or not.
Yeah, that's right. We kind of suspected that they weren't getting through because some people were just not getting replies. So I had a direct message over Twitter, which I got, which said, "Did you get my SMS?" And I said no, because I hadn't got it, and that test message never came.
And do you suspect that was the case throughout the country?
I guess so. I think it's just the whole network would have been overloaded at that point. And at the very end, you know, at the New Year's Eve, like about 15 minutes before the countdown to zero, there's often a message from the telephone company saying, "Please don't send message exactly at midnight because the whole network would be overloaded."
Stuart, in Japan, at least in the metropolitan areas, do a lot of people still receive television over the air? And what about radio? Those systems would seem to be less affected by infrastructure outages.
Yeah, that's right. Over the air television is quite well, pretty much the norm. Some people are going to cable for their normal TV, and there's a transfer over to the digital system planned later in this year. So we're switching over this year. Radio, of course, is a constant throughout, and I tend not to listen to the Japanese radio outside of the car, In this area, in the Kanto area, where we Tokyo and the surrounding metropolitan area is, because of the U.S. base, there's an actual U.S. radio station operating on 810 AM, which is the Far East Network, or I'm not sure what its name is these days. But But that is for the military personnel who may be out and about in the area. And so there's disaster kind of related information on that service in England.
Now, I heard a report on BBC actually from someone who was living over there. Who said that it was rather hard for him to view Japanese media because, and you know, I might have this wrong, but basically it's part of Japanese culture to maintain a face that things are as normal as possible, and that any crisis is being dealt with, and that people should not panic. Looking at some sample websites right now, I sort of see that being backed up. I'm looking at CNN. Of course, this could also speak to our desire to have big headlines. But CNN headline has spent fuel rods exposed, raising concerns. MSNBC, radiation extremely high at plant. The New York Times, United States calls radiation extremely high and urges deeper caution in Japan. And then I go over to NHK in Japan, and the headline is G7, G20 talks to be held on quake hit Japan. No health risk 20 kilometers away from plant. New power lines being planned for cooling system. Do you get the sense that maybe it's being toned down a bit over there?
Well, it's difficult to say, really. From what I know, the things that I've seen, I feel that the outside media is a little bit hyperactive and making the story looking for the story. But as you say, yeah, the way that like culturally that people communicate, things may not be said directly. So when people, it's been said that the way to understand the communication, like in a Western communication, it is your responsibility to communicate to the other person everything they need to know, to for them to understand what you're saying. But in the Japanese situation, it's more that you give them enough information and they are smart enough themselves to understand your clues as to what they're as to what you're saying. So there's a less directness in some of the ways that information will be communicated. So when you have a news conference and it's translated into English, and I think a lot of the obviously the Western journalists are picking up the English translations, they won't be getting the nuances of the Japanese way that it has been said. So I'm always concerned about, you know, what is the real, obviously the real story, and then looking at trying to look at what foreign experts are saying about the situation. But there seems to be a lot of misinformation, I think, on both sides. For example, from the pro-nuclear lobby, we'll be playing it down and sending out information about, you know, there's no problem, and you know, this is within the design parameters. And then the anti-nuclear lobby will be playing it up. This is very, very dangerous, extremely, extremely dangerous. So it's very difficult to know where the line is, and that's taking up a lot of time, just reading through various news reports and checking the science out. Like when we hear that a gas like it has been released, you know, radioactive steam has been released from the reactor, then if you look at the science, you can find that you know, that contains, for example, radioactive isotopes of nitrogen, which have a half-life of 7 seconds. So within a few minutes, you know, they'll be completely safe. Now you wouldn't want to be standing next to that plume of gas when it comes out, because it would be highly radioactive at that point. But you know, once it's in the air, then within a few minutes, it's undetectable. But as I was saying at the very start of the program, like we're watching the Geiger counters, and I think many people in Tokyo have learned a lot of physics in the last week.
It's very difficult
to know when you see units about, you know, what does this mean? This, for example, count per second. What is the normal background radiation in your hometown? Because in Tokyo, it's about 20 counts per minute. In places in Europe, in England, where there's rocks that are like granite and releasing radon and other nuclear active particles in the rocks, then it's 100. So if Tokyo surges up to 100, well, we surged up a lot and it's very detectable. But then there are places in the world where they have that level of background radiation, and people live there without worrying about it. So,
Stuart, at what point will you, what will you gauge, use as a gauge to determine whether you will need to leave, and what would you do?
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's the big dilemma right now. I know many friends have actually left. There's people who, as soon as the earthquake struck, booked a ticket and flew out. I'm established in this area. I have my own family, my Japanese family, in the area. So I will be staying with them. And if they're evacuated, I will go with them. But one of the kind of the canary in the mine will be the U.S. base. If the U.S. base nearby evacuates, then that is a sign that it's time to think about it. It's time to move, because they service nuclear powered aircraft carrier there, so they have on site technicians there who are very familiar, and they have all of the measuring equipment themselves, so they're not relying on anybody else to give them information. And if they evacuate, then that's really time to go.
Now, the distance that you are from the epicenter of all this, how are things by you so far as the people? Do the people around you seem to be sort of still primarily in crisis mode or trying to get back to normal, or how are things?
Well, it's very mixed. I don't see anybody panic. Even when you look at the centers where the people are staying, who've lost everything, there's no panic there. You see, on the tsunami videos, there is panic, obviously, because that's an instant situation. When I walk around, I see a little bit of tension. For the first time ever, I've seen empty shelves in Japan. I've never seen that. But it's strange, really. Like there is very little bread. People are buying up bread. You'd think that there would be a big run on rice, but I think maybe people are thinking that they lose power, they can't cook, so bread is something to stock up. But that's not going to be more for, you know, useful for more than a few days. In Tokyo, there's a power saving is going on. Everybody is trying to cut down as much as they can on their heating, lighting, shop signs are off. So for the first time ever, Shinjuku and Shibuya were dark. They're normally lit up at night, all through the night, with neon signs.
That's like the Times Square of Tokyo, correct?
Exactly, yeah. So it was dark. I saw pictures of that. And even in my local neighborhood, I can see quite a lot of shops have turned off their lights at night. And it's almost a kind of a sign of support and solidarity if your light is off. You know, if you've got a big brand name site there on the horizon, it just means that you're wasting electricity.
Now, I think that this is like a bit of a testament to the Japanese culture. I mean, we were just talking a lot about how people... expats or just people living over there, or the foreign media is complaining about how there's not, the sensationalist coverage about this issue. But then, you know, you're seeing this kind of issue that if it happened elsewhere, you could easily see a lot of people panicking or running in the streets or, you know, just a lot of disorder. Meanwhile, here we're hearing about how people are very orderly handling it, even with, you know, there being shortages in food and rolling blackouts and entire towns being destroyed. You know, it's very interesting to see.
Yes, I think that there's a lot of fundamental things in the Japanese culture which help this, and neighborliness is still highly regarded. There are kind of neighborhood festivals throughout the year, and community groups, and even outside of the you know, this kind of disaster situation, there's like in the winter time, you know, the people will walk around the areas at night time with banging a piece of wood together, and it's just like an old fashioned sound, like a click click sound you can hear at night time, and that's to remind people in the very dry winter to be careful with fires, because in the olden days, like with all the houses made of wood, if you had a fire in the winter, the whole village could go up. And those kind of traditions still go on about you know, being aware of danger, and of course in the Tokyo area, we're still expecting our big earthquake. 1923 was the last one, which was a huge disaster in this area. The Sendai one is in a completely different plate in the geological region. So Tokyo is in a very dangerous place geologically. There's three active plates that come together at one point. And in most places in the world, there's only two plates interacting at a time. So you know, there's tensions build up and are released by the earthquakes. And the other night, some of you may have seen, there was quite a strong earthquake close to Tokyo. But that was more towards Mount Fuji on that side of the tectonic plate. So whenever there's a release of tension in one part, it can mean a buildup of tension in another plate. So that could pass on the danger to another place.
Well, Tokyo, as many of us know, is probably the most prepared city in the world for earthquakes. But to give a sense, the earthquake that happened last Friday was thousands of times more powerful than the one that that decimated Haiti, and it speaks to what could have happened had you guys not been as prepared. It would have been even more of a catastrophe than what we've seen so far.
That's right. Especially after the Kobe earthquake, even the regulatory codes for buildings were stepped up, and many things were rechecked. We saw that the expressway in Kobe fell over when there was the large quake there, and they went back and they found that there were kind of defects in the concrete, and so there was a big program of re-strengthening all of the same kind of joints with extra cladding, steel cladding. And as you say, being prepared, it's probably the most prepared. But on an individual level, I certainly now feel I wasn't prepared enough, because having, you know, a certain amount of supplies at home, that if there was kind of shortages in the stores for people hoarding, like at the moment, people are saying that toilet paper is in short supply, and it's purely due to just people securing their own supply while it's in the stores.
Now, but Japan has a really fraught relationship with nuclear power and nuclear relations, especially after Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Why do you think the Japanese population was willing to accept nuclear power stations in the country? They have like a similar, I mean, they don't have as many as France per se, but why were they willing to build them there after the culture is so fearful of nuclear weapons?
Hello?
Yeah, can
okay, sorry. I'm fine.
Are you able to hear Voltaire's question?
Sorry, no, I missed this question.
Okay, I guess that's the microphone that doesn't work. You know what? It might be just as well as a great question, but for you to answer that, I think would take quite a while. Basically, it was why are Japanese embracing nuclear power after the history, in the past? Might it be something that they would shy away from? And if you could answer that in just about 30 seconds, that would be just great.
Okay, well, I think that Japan is heavily reliant on oil, so there's no natural oil reserves. So we have hydroelectric power and gas and, brought in from Brunei and oil. So nuclear gives Japan the independence. But as you say, from I think there's no stigma about using the peaceful nuclear technology, but whether it's safe to build the power station so close to active fault is really under discussion now. I'm kind of reconsidering whether that side of the argument is wise, because it's tsunami damage, and it has really shown that it's dangerous to be by the sea.
All right, we've been speaking with Stuart, our friend, listener over in Japan, and Stuart. In these last moments, is there any kind of an action that you could suggest people here in the United States can take to help with the situation?
Please give generously to the international relief organizations that you know and trust. Be careful not to get scammed online. There was a report of many scam domains set up with legitimate sounding name. So if you know the organization well, like the Red Cross and other organizations like that, I know that the Tokyo Hackerspace now are starting some project. So if you can look at their homepage and see, especially if you can get involved and support them, that would be great.
All right, Stuart. Our thoughts are with you, and of course we'll stay in touch, and get more updates as they come in. But I really hope things improve and work out over there, and that this tragedy will be overcome. Again, thanks so much for talking to us tonight.
No problem. It's been a pleasure.
All right, and we have this update. We wanted to talk about the Bradley Manning case, the whole State Department controversy, where the spokesman actually had to resign because of things he said. We'll speak about that next week, but we do want to tell people that on the 20th, which is Sunday, actually on the 19th and 20th, there will be all kinds of demonstrations throughout the country, maybe throughout the world, about Bradley Manning. Go to www.bradleymanning.org for updates on things that are going on in your area. And write to us at oth@2600.com with your feedback, comments, things like that. Again, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
I don't need a passport to walk on this earth. Anywhere I go, because I was made of this earth. I'm born of this earth. I breathe of this earth. And even with the pain, I believe in this earth. So I wake up every morning and I'm stepping on the floor. I wake up every morning and I'm stepping out the door. I got faith in the sky, faith in the one, faith in the people rocking underneath the sun. Cause every bit of land is a holy land, and every drop of water is a holy water, and every single child is a son or a daughter of the one earth mama and the one earth papa. So don't tell a man that he can't come here, cause he got brown eyes and a wavy kind of hair. And don't tell a woman that she can't go there, because she prays a little different to a God up there. You say you're a Christian cause God made you. You say you're a Muslim cause God made you. You say you're a Hindu and the next man a Jew. Then we all kill each other cause God told us to. No, hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
Bonjour, bonjour.
Follow me, let me take you to the dance on. I took a mask and came to the dance. follow me. Let me take you to the dance, son. Enough, your hairstyle, and yes.
So you dance to the rhythm, bounce to the rhythm, shake to the rhythm, and you roll to the rhythm. Sweat to the rhythm, get wet to the rhythm, make love to the rhythm, clean up to the rhythm. When you're moving, you come alive, and when you're grooving, in rhythm we survive. So don't panic, don't panic. No drum machines, this is all organic. Just Sly and Robbie on the drums and the bass, Sticky on percussion, and we mashing up the place. Giving you a beat you can rock and roll to, giving you a sound you can shake your soul to. So hip-hoppers, punk rockers, loose rockers, even woodstockers, don't need a passport, just send a postcard. Send me a message, let me know how you are. Whether you are walking or driving in your car, throw your hands high, tell me who you are. Say hello, hello.
Rasta man, yes, they're going after the poor man from the army because he leaked the government secrets and thing. Oh, you know what? I have the wrong accent. I need the accent for St. Paddy's because tomorrow is St. Paddy's Day, which that means today is March the 16th. 2011 at WBAI New York 99.5 FM, also streaming on the web at WBAI.org, and this is the Personal Computer Shoe. Take it away, gents.
And this is Joe King. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. And Hank Key is with me here in the studio. Behind the console is... Who's behind the console, Hank?
Oh, that's our inimitable... I don't know. Inimitable what?
Well, we call it a PIA, but I don't know what you call it in radio talk.
That's
PIA it is.
Yeah.
Stevie Deeby, normally we would be welcoming our Left Coast correspondent, David Perry, but he's not on the Left Coast tonight.
He's celebrating the St. Paddy's Day where he's supposed to celebrate it.
He's in the Emerald Isle right now, even as we speak, where he tells me it's not that big a deal over there as it is here in New York.
Well, I think there's more Irish population in New York than there is in Ireland.
Well, you would think that because you just don't know. It's wrong. There are more in Ireland than here, but it's not that big a holiday there. Although St. Patrick was the individual who allegedly chased the snakes out of Ireland.
I thought it was the leprechaun.
No, they left the leprechauns, the fine little people they are.
I'm glad to, that we did finally hear from Dave Perry because he lives out in the West Coast, and there was a tsunami alert, and Santa Cruz got hit hard, and it was... Really was concerned about how he was, where he's living.
Funny, I didn't hear anything about that Santa Cruz being hit hard. I heard
my condolences go out to all of the Japanese families out there.
And still, it's really horrible.
Earthquake.
I gotta say,
tidal wave.
I gotta
nuclear reaction fail.
I gotta say, I got a bulletin from the FBI saying that the amount and number of scams. Having to do with raising money in order to give them to scammers instead of the people who might need it is extremely high. Doing a follow-up on that, I found that the Japanese have not invited or asked for, at this stage, any outside private help. They've asked for, equipment, heavy equipment help. The Japanese Red Cross has said that they do not want or need, at the moment, any donations. The American Red
Cross—they're a wealthy country.
The American Red Cross has said if you donate anything specifically for Japan, why that will show that you have your heart in the right spot. It's just a scam. That's
right.
But that's not a bad scam. That's an intermediate scam.
But yeah, yeah. They still spend the money where they want.
But if you get yourself any email saying, you know, click here and make a $10 donation or a $100 donation, I've gotten several pieces of scam asking me to text a certain number. So a couple of those numbers I checked are legitimate. It's the Red Cross. But they're not asking for donations of that type yet. If you do, however, really want to make a donation to Japan, the American Red Cross, in New York, the Japan Society on East 47th Street, there are a few other legitimate places you can. But they're not asking for it.
Obama did an interview on ESPN, and he gave out a particular website that you can go to donate to Japan. I just don't know what that website is, but check their link. I did
it. Google it. You might find it.
Yeah.
Okay, Hank?
Yes, I just want to, at the top of the show, say that we aired, and I misspoke. When we were talking about IPv6, I had the exponential factor in my head, and I had a brain lock on it. It's not a 6-bit code, it's a 128-bit. So it's a 128-bit address.
What was 4?
4 is 32 bits.
And what's the difference in the number of addresses available, roughly?
Huge. Let's say it's huge.
Okay. Roughly, it's huge.
Let's put it this way. For it to exceed it, we would have to have a population growth is many times our current, 6-7 billion people?
Oh, I don't think that's true, Hank. I think, however, it does mean that everybody on the planet would have to double, triple, and quadruple the number of computers they have, right?
However, the only problem I find with it is that, you know, I've worked with IPv6, and the address is in hexadecimal, and most of us don't think that way. Whereas with IPv4, you know, you go from 0 to 255 with each segment. But when you have to think in hexadecimal, well, I guess we have to just retrain our brain.
The other thing you said last week I found puzzling, because you said that most of the, I think you said routers, which now we're handling IPv4,
right,
would not be useful. Well, you'd have to replace them. And I read an article on that after you said that. Coincidentally, I read an article that said most of them will not have that problem. Most individuals will not have that problem.
That's not true. What they say is that if you read that article, it says that almost all of the current routers, if a firmware modification was made, you can easily adapt it to IPv6. The problem is there's so many models of it, and the manufacturers, I don't think they have the resources to do it, and many of them have not opted to do it or even announced that they would do it. And so that's why I made the statement that...
Well, the article I read, and I didn't fully understand it, had to do with NAS conversions, and that if your ISP could handle it, you could
Well, the ISP, I don't know how they're going to handle it, because some of them have routers and the modem integrated in one unit. Others have it as separate units, and I guess it really the only one that matters is the ISP you're using, because that's the one that's going to affect you.
That's exactly true. Next story.
Yeah, well, let me just comment on that, is because very often we get a question on the air, which ISP do you recommend? And the answer is it all depends where you live, because the same ISP serving different boroughs could have different results.
Actually, I recommend an ISP out in Nassau County.
If it's available to you, fine.
Which I can't use because they don't service Manhattan where I live.
Oh, you're talking about Fios.
I do. I really like the Fios setup. Stevie, you're now using Fios.
I love Fios. I just got upgraded. It works good, lasts a long time.
Are you going with the higher speed or the normal speed?
No, I've got the higher speed. I've got everything. All the channels?
I have all the channels, and I got the lower speed, and I can't tell it's the lower speed because it can't be any faster than instantaneous.
You know what? I'm making a big deal about it, but I really don't notice the difference. It's still fast.
If you click on something and it comes up, then...
It's fast.
It clicks
Stevie,
and comes
Stevie,
up.
Stevie, if you had the option to go with a slower speed at lower cost, you would do that?
Well, I might, because I'm not in a big hurry. But, I have a low cost.
Stevie has twice the speed that I have roughly.
35 up and 35 down?
And I'm 15.
Okay.
So, and I'm totally satisfied with the 15.
Yeah, I was before, too.
So there you go. Hank, what's next?
Well, Windows 7, there's a Service Pack 1 that was released recently, and I have installed it on at least 4 or 5 machines. However, it's been reported that if you are uploading Service Pack 1 or upgrading your machine off a Windows Server Update Services off an OEM machine.
What does that mean?
To most people, it doesn't matter to them because they thought they're not using an OEM machine.
What does that mean?
That means they're connected to a server that is updating their machine.
What is an OEM machine?
Thank you, Stevie.
It means that it's a machine that is running as a server, running with a service, running the OEM version of the operating system.
Stevie, would you explain what Hank just said?
A regular machine.
No.
A PC connected, used as a server.
No, not at all.
Okay, would somebody explain to me what you guys are talking about?
If you let me do it, I'll tell you, okay?
I'm asking.
If you are using an industrial server where you have basically
a RAID system,
you are using the Microsoft OEM version of the server, okay? Not some custom server, but the Microsoft version called WSUS, Windows Server Update Services, from Microsoft. Some people have experienced some problems updating their machine. Other than that, though, most people that I have spoken to, and I myself, have not had problems installing SP1.
Well, I'm going to throw something at you, Hank. And
okay.
Let's see. I had a talk with somebody. He's actually more of a journalist than anything else. He writes a blog called Defensive Computing. You might have heard of him, a man named Michael Horowitz. He writes the blog for Computer World. He said that he and all of his friends and all of his acquaintances are holding back on the install.
Well, you can hold back on it, but I can tell you from a pragmatic experience that I have not had any problems with it. However, I would say that what it really is that it's all the patches lumped into one, and then they have two additional features that has to do with virtual memory, the virtual operating system, which a lot of people are not using. And so I would say that it's not a critical, it's not an urgent update, and if you don't want to do it, but make sure you get all your updates, you don't need SP1 right now. So he's partly right in the sense that there's no urgency to do it, but if it's there, I did it because I had to be able to report on it.
Well, I did it because I wanted to find out if you were telling the truth.
And did you have problems with it?
None whatsoever.
Okay, so then...
Well, that's not quite true. I had a minor problem. I called you up and you told me I had done something wrong.
No. Okay, now the other thing is that as of yesterday, or actually last night, and so I haven't had a chance to do it yet, but Internet Explorer 9 was released, and you can download it. However, if you have Windows XP, don't bother because it won't run on XP.
Now, should I replace my RC1 of Windows 9 of Internet Explorer 9, or can I just install this over that?
I'm not aware that people were putting RC IE9 on XP.
On XP. I'm talking about on 7. I did it, the RC on 7.
Oh, I haven't had a chance to try it yet, so I will probably get back to the listeners next week.
How about Vista?
In other words, it's available for Vista. It's available for 7, but not for not for XP. And the reason they gave is that it has to do with the graphics card, a hardware acceleration. However, I think that's a flimsy excuse because Firefox has that capability and it supports it. And so I think it's just their marketing move to move people off of XP.
Right.
And however, there are some new features with 9. Again, until I try it out, I